This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Memorial Day, 2009. On a day we pause to remember the high cost of human conflict, North Korea shook the world awake with a new nuclear threat, an underground explosion the size of the ones that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And if those horrible memories of mass destruction weren't enough of a lesson of where this can lead, what might the world do now to head off a new global crisis? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. On this day, we pay tribute to those who sacrificed for all of us. Glad you're able to share some time here. North Korea's defiant test of that nuclear bomb has prompted international condemnation and calls for stiffer sanctions. But even amid great economic and political turmoil, isolation doesn't seem to be working and money doesn't seem to be talking. So what options does that leave the U.S. and its allies? Here's our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale.
The Obama administration came into office offering to engage North Korea with high-level talks. That ended when the North tested a long-range missile last month, and today President Obama took time out from his Memorial Day rounds to accuse North Korea of ignoring its own commitments to abandon nuclear weapons.
Its actions have also flown in the face of United Nations resolutions. As a result, North Korea is not only deepening its own isolation, it's also inviting stronger international pressure.
Those UN sanctions did nothing to deter North Korea's nuclear ambitions, and U.S. efforts to interrupt the flow of international financing for North Korea's nuclear operations begun 5 years ago were also unsuccessful. Georgetown University professor Victor Cha says there's not much the U.S. or other Western countries can do to persuade North Korea to stop. He says there's only one country with any influence.
The Chinese have a wealth of relationships with the North, some of them public in terms of publicly reported trade figures and some of them not so public, that they can use to put leverage on the North Koreans to try to bring them back to the talks and to get them to stop these missile tests and these nuclear tests.
China's leadership today issued a rare criticism of North Korea, saying Beijing was resolutely opposed to nuclear testing. Professor Cha says the U.S. willingness to meet with Pyongyang's leaders means China can no longer blame the U.S. for provoking North Korea, and he hopes that will persuade China to put more backbone into future international sanctions. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
General Motors is up against another deadline tomorrow. The automaker owes bondholders $27 billion.
As a key part of its struggle to avoid bankruptcy, it wants to swap that debt for stock and what bondholders see as just a sliver of the pie. They have till tomorrow to make up their minds, but it's pretty clear a lot of them have already decided to reject the offer. Quick on the heels of that comes a June 1st deadline for bankruptcy, and as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, that outcome is looking more and more likely.
Mark Modica's life savings is invested in General Motors bonds. He works for a Saturn dealership outside Philadelphia. Modica was counting on the interest on those bonds to help carry him into retirement. Now GM is asking him to forgo that interest in exchange for stock in the company worth far less. Like many bondholders, he plans to say no.
They made an offer we cannot accept, so it's their choice. Now the country is going to suffer for it, and I want to make sure the country knows whose decision it was.
Modica blames President Obama's auto task force. He says it's asking bondholders to give up far more than other stakeholders in exchange for less. Bondholders would get a 10% stake in the company. The government and a union healthcare trust would share most of the rest. To avoid bankruptcy, GM needs 90% of its bondholders to approve the deal. That's looking unlikely. A committee representing major debt holders says they plan to reject the offer. Gerald Myers is former chairman of American Motors Corporation. He says GM is running out of options.
The government has shown that it's serious and it intends to pull the chain. So I have every expectation here in town, that is in Michigan, that GM will be bankrupt in some form of bankruptcy this time next week.
GM would join rival Chrysler in bankruptcy. Chrysler filed last month after some of its debt holders held out for a better deal in court. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street had the day off. Markets in Europe were mixed. Details when we do the numbers. This day being the unofficial kickoff to summer, yay! A lot of us might be thinking of vacationing and relaxing. But it's just the opposite for many teens. A lot of them are plotting their path to finding a summer job.
I put in applications everywhere more than once. I go to interviews and they still don't call back.
You need jobs like In-N-Out, you still need like 4.0 GPA, something like that. You know, some places are just getting harder and harder.
They're looking for people with experience. Most young people don't really have experience.
That was Delissa Franklin, Juan Del Portillo, and Carolina Velasco here in L.A. To find out what teens can do to get a leg up, we have Carol Kristen here. She's author of What Color Is Your Parachute for Teens? Carol, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. It's lovely to be here.
So what is the job situation like for teens this summer?
Well, this summer it's a little different than it's been and a little trickier. People have been writing that it's the worst job market since World War II. And this generation of teens is in competition with people their grandparents' age, their parents' age, and their older cousins and brothers and sisters' age.
Have you heard anything about what the reaction to students has been to this tough job market so far?
This is a generation that has more millionaires under the age of 25 from being young entrepreneurs than any generation previously. But it's also what we call everybody gets a blue ribbon generation. And when you talk with employers, this sense of, I'm wonderful, I can do anything, you ought to be paying me, you know, $15 an hour, even though I've never worked before, comes back to haunt. Because when you're looking for a job, that's the antithesis of everybody gets a blue ribbon. Only one person gets the job. So you're really going to have to make yourself stand out.
And there's always that catch-22 of how do you get experience if you don't have experience yet?
That's right. And the one thing that breaks that catch is to volunteer, to go someplace where you know you're going to gain the skills and experience that will get you a job that you want to be paid for. And you say, okay, would you take me on for 4 weeks, 4 hours a day, and let me learn?
I wonder if one of the upsides of this isn't learning things the hard way, though. I mean, teens have to face the reality of a tough job market now sooner than others in this case.
I've been in this business since the mid-70s, and I think most people spend, you know, more time filing their nails than they do on keeping up their employability. You know, what's the job market like? Where's the demand? How do I look down the road and see what's coming? And I think that this reality is going to be with us for several years. It's going to be a tough job market. So teens can have an advantage now of saying, hey, I need to prepare myself for the work world. What can I do this summer that will make me more employable next summer?
What's the secret right now? Who's hiring at this moment?
That varies by region, but there's a little bit of money coming into outdoor programs through the stimulus. Fast food is one of those things that, you know, there's a 300% turnover, so that's always a good place to look. But things that young people ought to think of, if they can't find a job that somebody's going to pay them for, what can they do? What services can they offer? What goods or products can they make?
Carol Kristen is a consultant and author of What Color Is Your Parachute for Teens? Thanks for working with us on this holiday, Carol.
Thank you.
Carol also has some tips for teens on our website. It's marketplace.org. Life on the edge of a cliff is nothing new for Mesquite, Nevada. It's a town set among some spectacular red rock bluffs right along the Arizona border. Through the years, it's been a rendezvous point for my family on the highway out of Las Vegas to points north and east. The laid-back lifestyle is an attraction for gamblers, golfers, and retirees, but lately it's way too quiet. Tourism's down a third from last year. The owner of three casinos in town is struggling, and one resort's already gone dark. The other day, I pulled off the road to check out some familiar surroundings. I've watched this place go from a tiny little town to a boom town, and now a town on the edge. It was right here on this spot, in fact, that I played my very first slot machine at the age of 5. I can still remember giggling as my grandfather lifted me within reach of a one-armed bandit. I also vividly recall the crabby waitress who rushed over to enforce the rules and spoil the fun as the slot machine poured out what to my wide eyes was a river of shimmering silver. Funny how childhood memories end up being bigger than life. Actually, way back then, Mesquite was hardly more than a tiny blink-and-you'll-miss-it refueling outpost in the desert. Its early Mormon settlers turned the bright red soil here green with alfalfa to supply their horse ranches. Later, slot machines were treated almost as an afterthought. At least that's how Alan Green remembers it. His father-in-law, Cy Red, took over a sleepy truck stop back in the early 1980s and discovered to his amazement that the previous owners didn't seem to think of gambling as part of their business plan.
Cy always thought it was kind of funny that when he bought it, it had 23 slot machines and only half of them worked. And he realized that they were such good Mormons they didn't want to see people gamble.
The modest property became a full-service resort called The Oasis. A rival developer named Merv Griffin built another resort across the street, and a third casino operator eventually bought control of all three properties. Then came a fourth resort. Alan Green, who ran The Oasis for several years, concedes the casino rush was dizzying.
Maybe too many, too fast. Oversaturation.
Suddenly, tiny Mesquite became Nevada's fastest-growing city, and for a time, the fastest-growing small town in America. In barely a decade, the population soared from a few hundred to nearly 20,000. And then, quicker than it came, the boom suddenly went bust, capping a ruinous year for the whole state's gaming and tourism business. Breathless Las Vegas newscasters reacted to the surprise mothballing of the Oasis Casino as if the whole community had just rolled snake eyes.
500 jobs at the Oasis will be cut.
The city is worried the layoffs will be disastrous.
In a small community like Mesquite that relies heavily on the casino industry, it creates fear citywide.
First, your stomach lurches.
That's Mesquite Mayor Susan Holacek.
You have this almost crushing sense. How are you going to be able to get these people into jobs, and how quickly can you do it?
The added worry in a small town like this is that the sudden loss of 500 jobs can fast lead to more layoffs. A Denny's restaurant worker named Laura, for example, only a week after the nearby casino shut down, she lost the job she had just found. She spoke to me through a caseworker at the local family services center.
Nomás trabajé la primera semana de diciembre.
You only worked the first week of December.
She was laid off just that quickly.
Sí, ya la siguiente, a la segunda semana ya no fue a trabajar más.
After the second week, she no longer went back to work. She was let go, laid off.
The deeply in debt casino operator, Black Gaming, is still struggling to hold off creditors and keep its two remaining resorts in town going, and the company still hopes the Oasis can be saved. But when attorney Chris Kempfer went before a city council meeting representing the town's biggest single employer, he could offer no promises at all about the future.
Anybody who stands up here and gives you any kind of guarantees is doing themselves a disservice and you a disservice. And we will not and cannot do that because of the uncertainty and changing nature of this economy.
By now, you might imagine a city reeling in fear that it could end up becoming a modern-day Nevada ghost town. But the mayor insists you'd be as wrong as those naysayers who counted out the first settlers when flash floods washed them away.
The people who kept coming to Mesquite were the people who said, gosh darn it, we're going to keep trying.
And with that, the city's economic development director, Brian Dangerfield, takes me out to see Mesquite's own stimulus plan, heading over one of the city's three highway crossings.
This is kind of the middle connector, so you don't have to go from one end of town to next just to get over the freeway.
I remember when Mesquite used to have one connector.
Yeah, you're showing your age.
Dangerfield shows off the city's popular golf resorts in a sprawling Sun City retirement development that's forging ahead with strong sales.
Do you want to get out real quick?
Sure.
But it's this newly planned attraction the town's just landed that my tour guide hopes will bring even more visitors.
This Desert Falls project is every sports person's dream.
In the days after the big casino layoff, Mesquite saw the chance to catch a lucky break. The city just committed to selling a big block of land for a $500 million international sports training and tournament complex. Dangerfield envisions pro and amateur teams and athletes flocking to games, camps, and clinics. And he sees some even more immediate benefits in the construction jobs it'll be created. No matter that it's such a huge commitment at such an uncertain time.
You know, sure, we're concerned, but now is the time to do. Now is the time to take the chance and to be ready when the economy comes back.
Dangerfield says history shows those who stay in the game, even through tough times, come out ahead. So city leaders consider it a safe bet on their economic future. You can take a look at this little town that's trying to buck long odds. We've got some special slideshows at marketplace.org. Coming up, a Marine weighs the costs of his future.
When I started looking seriously at colleges, I realized that the government money wouldn't pay for more than a few semesters of tuition and rent. Beatnik fantasies cost more than I'd ever realized.
But first, let's do the numbers. Not many numbers to do on this Memorial Day. U.S. markets were closed in observance of the holiday and stock exchanges in the United Kingdom for a national banking holiday. Frankfurt's DAX shaved off 0.3%, but in Paris, the CAC 40 nudged up 0.2%. Asian markets shrugged off North Korea's nuclear test, and Tokyo's Nikkei got a boost of 1.3% as Japan raised its economic outlook for the first time in 3 years. Markets in mainland China and Singapore also closed in positive territory. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society. FFYF.org. And by the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and its 57th Annual Management Conference with faculty debating the future of markets. May 29th, chicagobooth.edu. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board releases the Consumer Confidence Index for May. And the pressure is on. Events get underway for the Scripps National Spelling Bee. Do you know how to spell gambling? I bet you already know that registration opens for the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Seems appropriate on this Memorial Day to give some thought to the plight of many who serve and sacrifice above and beyond the call of duty. There's a federal law that says soldiers, Marines, airmen, and sailors shouldn't have to worry about losing their jobs when they deploy. But that promise can ring hollow for reservists who also own small businesses. It's hard to find a fill-in boss for a 16-month tour, especially if it happens two or three times. For the National Guardsmen we're about to meet, war meant closing up shop for good. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Colonel Daniel Bordelon faced death while serving in the National Guard. His battlefield wasn't Afghanistan, but New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. The storm turned his 100-acre post into a torrent of flood water 20 feet deep in some places.
Well, we started walking, me and one other guy. By the time we got to right about here, it was already over our heads, and we swam the rest of the way.
Now Bordelon's in charge of rebuilding the same barracks where he almost drowned.
10 o'clock staff meeting.
Roger, sir.
He oversees a budget of $170 million and 80 staffers.
A quick program update. If we could just go around the horn, what's going on in your projects, up, down, sideways. Go ahead, Nick.
It's been more than 4 years, and Bordelon remains on active duty in New Orleans. The extended activation has put an end to his old life as a small business owner.
Before Katrina, I was a chiropractor. Before the mobilization, I was a chiropractor with offices in two different cities, about 30, 40 miles apart.
Bordelon's practice represented two decades of work. The offices had finally started to turn a profit, and he had hundreds of patients. But then came National Guard deployment. When that happens, the Guard is no longer voluntary weekend duty. It's full-time work, and resigning is not an option. When he was mobilized, Bordelon tried to sell his practice, but the offer fell through the day he left for duty. He had no other choice but to liquidate.
I didn't have two or three other chiropractors working for me that could carry the load for me to be gone a year. I was the only guy. So, I mean, as a chiropractor, when your hands leave, you know, your feet leave the building, you stop making money. You stop having a business.
The 46-year-old lost hundreds of thousands of dollars when the deal collapsed. Bordelon's still navigating the financial hardship and his new fixed income from the military. That smaller salary has to stretch pretty far, too. Bordelon's a divorced father and supports sons Jake and Nick and dog Coco.
Come on, Nick.
What you doing?
Most weekdays, he races home from work to pick them all up at his mother's house.
So what went on to school today?
After a day of rebuilding the barracks, Bordelon has to worry about rebuilding his own house. It's in Lakeview, a New Orleans neighborhood that was flooded during Katrina. So on the way home, father, sons, and dogs stop at Home Depot for a plumbing connection they've been needing.
We're going to turn our water on tonight. Y'all get to take baths.
Before bath time, though, Bordelon gathers up the boys for pizza at his best friend's house in New Orleans.
He's got the largest title transfer company in Louisiana.
Even though Bordelon lost his chiropractic offices, he still gives adjustments to family and friends. Bordelon's high school buddy, Bob Bergeron, is face down on the coffee table in the living room, a bit stressed.
Bob, we're not wrestling. There you go. Got it.
It was Bob Bergeron who talked Bordelon into joining the National Guard after high school. Bergeron says they both needed help for college.
I got in because I couldn't afford the tuition, and the National Guard offered a scholarship to pay for 2 years.
Bergeron got out of the Guard in 2003, just after he'd started his own law firm, Crescent Title Company. The Iraq War was underway. Bergeron knew there was a good chance his unit would be activated. Unlike his best friend, he chose his business over the Guard.
So my option was stay in and risk being activated or get out. And I had started a company with 5 employees, and if I was activated, that was it. My law firm was one lawyer, so if the lawyer is gone, the law firm dismantles. So it was really because of my job.
With a new administration and a new defense secretary, deployment length could shrink. But the change, if it happens, comes too late for Colonel Daniel Bordelon. He thinks about rebuilding his own business someday, but not right now.
Right now, as a battalion commander, I would feel really bad that I'll be bailing on my soldiers. When we're facing deployment, here's the commander leaving, facing deployment. You know, why should I go?
That same sense of duty is probably what led Bordelon to make the choice to stay in the Guard in the first place, no matter the cost to him personally. In New Orleans, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Colonel Bordelon shows us where he almost died during Hurricane Katrina and how his crew saved him in a video on our website, marketplace.org. Sacrifice comes in many ways for American veterans. Anthony Swofford served in the First Gulf War as an elite sniper in the Marines. His best-selling memoir, Jarhead, shares that story. When he came back from months of active duty, where he marched through burning oil fields and sifted through bombed Iraqi corpses, he prepared to enter civilian life and faced a grim economic reality.
As a corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps, I made less than $800 a month after taxes. My car payment was around $180 a month. I drove a modest Nissan 4x4 pickup. The rest of the money I spent on car insurance, food, that mainstay of the Marine diet, beer, and the gas I needed to escape from the desert Marine base of 29 Palms to Los Angeles on the weekends. We'd been back from the Gulf War for a year, but combat still haunted us, and we were always ready to fight the next battle. It should come as no surprise that many of us looked over our finances with aggressive irresponsibility, if not outright malevolence. If you might die very soon, why on earth should you care about your bank balance? They can't squeeze car payments from a dead Marine, can they? Then borrow the money for the car at a criminally high APR from one of those jalopy dealers outside the base. Say yes to that credit card, and say yes to that one as well. I'd always planned to leave the Marine Corps after 4 years to attend college. I was in that fourth year, and I'd saved exactly $0 beyond the $14,000 in my GI Bill. I'd live with the fantasy that the GI Bill would see me through an undergrad degree and onto graduate school, and that I'd not have to work. When I started looking seriously at colleges, I realized that the government money wouldn't pay for more than a few semesters of tuition and rent. Beatnik fantasies cost more than I'd ever realized. I began to panic. A Marine I knew, who had three kids and an unemployed wife, had been delivering for a Pizza Hut out in town. The moonlighting Marine was a common enough sight. They worked as bartenders, taxi drivers, and motel clerks, but most of those guys were married with kids. One afternoon, I headed out to the Pizza Hut. The manager looked like a cousin to the Mario Brothers. He hired me on the spot and gave me a uniform and told me to report the next day, a Friday, at 4. Depressingly, the Pizza Hut uniform shared a color scheme with the vaunted Marine Corps dress blues. The polyester pants were blue, and the shirt was blue and red with blue piping. After a 5K run in the morning and an afternoon on the rifle range, I shed my battle dress camouflage uniform. I made the horrible mistake of donning the Pizza Hut threads while still in the barracks. At the time, I was a co-leader of my platoon, and as my men changed into shorts, t-shirts, and flip-flops and prepared to party like it was 1999, I walked a reverse walk of shame from the barracks to the parking lot. My subordinates howled in delight as they watched their fearless leader scamper off to deliver pizzas. I could find my way on foot with a map and compass through any landscape on earth, but in my truck was rather lost in the sprawling exurbs of the high desert. I bungled more than a few deliveries and received multiple cold pizza complaints. I delivered to a number of military families, and I recall these people averting their gaze when something in my bearing or my haircut tipped them off that I was a Marine. As I recall, I made about $40 that night. When I got back to the barracks after midnight, my men were sufficiently drunk and passed out that I was able to slip into my room unnoticed. I looked at myself in the mirror, hair askew, a little puffy at the eyes. The pizza-stained uniform made my combatant's body look like a sack of bloated dough. I did the simple math. In 8 months, I'd be out of the Corps, and my moonlighting would have netted me a few thousand dollars at most. I never went back. Better to be a very broke college student than a member of the world's most elite fighting force, schlepping deep dish on a Friday night.
Anthony Swofford's latest book is the novel Exit A.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, you might know that Japan is a country where children are traditionally warned that ghosts might be hiding out in the bathroom. Now, the Japanese author who wrote the horror story The Ring, which was made into a Hollywood movie, has come up with a novel way to sell his new novella, which is set in a bathroom. It's being printed on a roll of toilet paper, proving without a doubt that marketing is finally going into the toilet. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed for the Memorial Day holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, companies may try to sidestep a cap on carbon.
They'll move to China, so they take advantage of cheap electricity from these filthy coal-fired plants in China. And they'll supply the American market from these locations.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.